Today's shiur has been dedicated by Avram Deutsch. He has made the dedication as a schus for the Israeli army. The schus of Torah learning from this shiur should be a protective merit for our soldiers who risk their lives every day to protect Eretz Yisrael. Hashem should be with them, protect them, allow them to succeed. And the merit of our Torah study and our prayers. We were up to Yudalit Amud Beis. The second line from the bottom, the second last word on the line where it says, "My Erechin." At the end of yesterday's daf, we were discussing the different cases in the Mishnah of consecrated items that need to be redeemed. So let's say, for example, somebody donated some object to the Beis HaMikdash. So now, of course, it has a consecrated status, and it belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. However, it's possible to redeem that property by paying the value to the Beis HaMikdash. So now the money becomes consecrated, and the item is no longer consecrated. It's regular chulin. It's not a holy object anymore. It could be used for mundane purposes. Our Mishnah taught us that with regards to the process of appraising the item, determining its proper value, in the case of a movable property that was consecrated for the Beis HaMikdash, we require a panel of three experts to do the appraisal. Then the Mishnah talked about another case using a curious phrase. Mishnah then went on to say that erechin hametaltalim, movable objects that are the subject of an erech vow, Mishnah says also in that case we require a panel of three experts to appraise the object. The problem is it's hard to fathom what this could refer to, because what does the word erech mean? Erech refers to certain assigned values that the Torah assigns to people. It is. The Torah says that if somebody promises, he pledges, I'm going to donate the erech value of some person, or perhaps he says the erech value of himself, the halacha is that the amount he has to give depends on which category the person that he used in his erech vow falls under. And these categories that the Torah delineates are defined by age and gender. So depending on the age and gender of the subject, the person who made this erech vow would have to give a certain amount, that fixed amount. It's all about the categories. We don't take into account this person's individual worth. Like, let's say he's big and strong, or he could do skilled labor. All of that is irrelevant to erechin. Rather, it's simply these categories strictly based on age and gender. And each category is assigned a different amount. So it seems totally nonsensical to discuss erechin hametaltalin. Movables that are erechin, what could that mean? Gemara asks, my erechin hametaltalin. What do you mean movables that have erech vows? Somebody made an erech vow with a movable object? The problem is there's no such thing. Again, this whole halach of erechin refers to somebody who promises to donate money to the Beis HaMikdash based on a human subject. So it's not obvious at all what the Mishnah is saying here. So the Gemara suggests the answer. I'm Rav Gidel, I'm a Rav. Rav Gidel said in the name of Rav that our Mishnah is referring to the following situation. Be'omer, somebody said, Erech Kli Zeh Olai. Somebody got up and said, I hereby pledge to donate the Erech value, the fixed value, that special Erech term, of this Kli, some vessel, some utensil. The halacha is, this person now owes the value of that utensil to the Beis HaMikdash. But what do you mean? I thought we just said that the term erech does not refer to market value and it cannot be applied to movables. The answer is, that's the point. That is, we say, since if we take these words at face value, it's totally meaningless. It doesn't mean anything to say I'm giving the erech value of an object. There's no such thing. We therefore assume that this donor really meant to say he wants to give the market value of the movable object in question. The Amar of Gidel Amarav, as Rav Gidel Amarav said elsewhere, continuing to test Vav Amid Aleph. Rav Gidel Amarav rules that HaOmer Erech Kli Zeh Olai, if somebody were to use such a language, he pledges, I hereby commit myself to give the Erech value of this utensil. Halacha is no Sein Damav. He gives the market value of that object to the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara explains this further. My taima, what's the reason? How does it make sense if he said, I want to give the erech value that somehow we end up saying he gives the market value of the object? The answer is, Adam Yodea Shein Erech L'Kli. We say everybody knows, a person understands, he realizes that really there's no such thing as giving an Erech of a Kli. No such thing. Erech refers to, we said above, certain assigned fixed amounts for different categories of people. But he did say these words. He made this whole declaration. Presumably a person does not get up and make a whole declaration for not, for no reason. Just, you know, wasting his words, wasting his breath. So we say, V'gamar v'yamar l'shum damim. Must be what he really had in mind was to donate the market value of whatever object it was. Mishum hachi nosein damav. That is why in practice, halacha is he'll have to give the market value of that object that he mentioned in his declaration, in his pledge. And so Rav Gidol HaMarav's reading of our Mishnah is, the Mishnah says, Erech in a metalpelin, meaning, if somebody were to pledge, I hereby pledge to donate the Erech value of some metalpelin, some movable object, and halacha is b'shlosha. Three experts will have to appraise the value of the object in question, and this person will have to give that amount to the Beis HaMikdash. But the Gemara objects to this reading, that if that's what our Mishnah means to say, hi, erechin hametaltalin, this language the Mishnah used, that we're talking about a case of erechin, things, seems, given an erech value, hametaltalin, those things with the erech value are movable. This does not seem to be the correct choice of wording, according to Rav Gidol HaMarav's interpretation. For this wording implies, we're dealing with erech, and we're dealing with something which, you know, really has an erechin status. Just these things happen to be movable. That's not what's going on here, according to Rav Gidol HaMarav. Rather, erechin shel metaltalin mi boile. If anything, the Mishnah should have said, we're talking about metaltalin, regular movable objects. Mishnah should have said, if one does erechin of that, if one attempts to attach an erech vow to the Beis HaMikdash to a movable, then you need three experts to appraise that movable. The movable is the actual subject of the erech vow, according to Rav Gidol HaMarav. And again, the movable is not actually erech, it doesn't have an erechin status. So this interpretation does not seem to fit in the Mishnah's language. The Gemara answers, for Rav Gidol HaMarav, Tani Erechin Shel Metaltalin. Gidol HaMarav would say, amend the Mishnah to read Erechin of Metaltalin. The Gemara now offers another approach of Chista Amar Avimi. Chista said in the name of Avimi. Really, our Mishnah is referring to a person who made a regular old Erechin vow. For example, a person got up and said, I hereby pledge to donate my own Erech value to the Beis HaMikdash. And subsequently, in order to pay for his pledge, b'matfis metaltalin le'erechin, this person went ahead and assigned specific movables to use as payment for his Erech vow, which has the effect of consecrating those movables. The Mishnah is saying, if then the person wants to redeem the movables that are now assigned for payment for the Erech vow, the movables would need to be appraised by three experts. That's what our Mishnah is saying. And the Gemara says, again, it's not great in the Mishnah's language. For high Erechin hametaltalin, if this is the Mishnah's case, is the correct language, the Mishnah's language of Erechin that are movable, the Gemara says, no, if this is what the Mishnah was saying, metaltalin shel Erechin mi boile. The real focus should have been on the movables. And the movables are not inherently erechin, they were just used, they were assigned to pay for an erech vow. So Mishnah should have used the words movables that are of, that became associated with erechin because they were designated to pay for some erech vow, then you need three to appraise the movables. That's what the Mishnah should have said if that's what it really meant. The Gemara says, Rav Chista Amar Avimi Tni Metaltalin Shel Erechin. He would slightly modify the Mishnah's wording to read metaltalin of erechin, and then this interpretation is entirely plausible. The Gemara brings a third approach. Rabbi Avoa, Rabbi Avoa says, here's what's happening in our Mishnah. The case is, be'omer erchi alai. First, this person one day got up and pledged that it is upon me to donate the erech value of myself to the Beis HaMikdash. And then it came time to pay up, and he wasn't paying the cash, so ba kohen ligvos mimenu metaltalin. So the kohen, the collector, came to take, you know, whatever possessions he had to pay for the pledge. He came to take some movables to pay for this. Our Mishnah is teaching that when the kohen takes those movables, you have to appraise them, see how much they're worth to pay to this debt, and it's appraised b'shlosha by three experts. That's if it's movables. Mishnah goes on to say, karkos, if the kohen is seizing land from this person to pay for the pledge, basara, and the land must be evaluated by 10 people. That is, Rabbi Yevo proposes to like break up these words in the Mishnah. Don't read it altogether as erechin hamataltalin. Rather, you read it that the Mishnah starts out erechin. Mishnah says, when it comes to a person who makes an erech vow, and now it's time to collect, and the kohen comes to seize some property in order to collect for this erech vow this person made, the Mishnah explains, it depends what type of assets are being seized. Ha mitaltalin, if the kohen is seizing movable property, chattel, then the appraisal process is done by three. If the kohen is seizing karkos, if he is seizing land, and the appraisal is done by 10 people. The Gemara questions this last approach. Amar le Rav Achami Difti le Ravina. Vachram Difti asked Ravina that Bishlama Afuke me Hegdish Bainan Shlosha. I understand the first two approaches, of Gidom Rav's approach and of Chis's approach. In both of those readings of the Mishnah, we are discussing the process of redeeming a property that has a consecrated status. So it is well established that Torah says very clearly that when redeeming property that has a consecrated status, you need a number of people to oversee the appraisal process. So then fine. But according to Rabbi Avohu, what are we discussing here? We're discussing somebody's valuables sitting inside of his house, which are obviously not consecrated. And the kohen comes knocking on the door and saying, we need to take those to pay for your erech vow. Rav Acha asks, yule lehegdish, such a process of taking property and putting it in the Beis HaMikdash's treasury, shlosha lomali, why should three people be required to oversee that process? When you're not redeeming, you're not deconsecrating anything. Ramalei Ravina answers Rav Acha, svarahu, even if the Torah doesn't specifically require this, we conclude based on logic that a panel of three is required when bringing the property into the Beis HaMikdash as well. We say, mali ayuli, mali afuki. Why should there be any real distinction between ayuli, bringing it into the Beis HaMikdash, from taking it out of the Beis HaMikdash? For fuki, my taima. Ultimately, why does the Torah say that when redeeming something from the Beis HaMikdash, you have to do it with a panel of many people, a panel of three? The reason is, dil matai. Then we're worried, maybe I'll make a mistake. It won't be an accurate assessment. That same concern should apply in this direction as well. Yuli Nami, if he's bringing it up, putting it into the temple's treasury, same concern exists, of course, which is Dilmatai. Maybe if it's one person by himself, we'll make a mistake. And either the Beis HaMikdash won't get its fair due amount, or this person will fail to properly fulfill his promise to the Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, Bevo's interpretation is fine. He is saying that just like you need three to deconsecrate, you need three to consecrate, to take that property and put it in the Beis HaMikdash's treasury. Our Mishnah then brought the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who said that one of these three appraisers has to be a Kohen. This is based on the fact that the Pasuk mentions the word Kohen when it talks about redeeming consecrated property. And the Gemara asks, Amar le Rav Papa l'Abaye, Bishlama le Rav Yehuda, Hainu dechsev Kohen. Very good for Rav Yehuda's opinion. He's accounting for the fact that the Torah mentions Kohen. He says, yes, one of the appraisers must be a Kohen. Ela le Rabbanon Kohen lama lehu. But according to the Rabbanon, the first opinion of our Mishnah, it does not require one of the appraisers be a Kohen. Why then does the Torah use the word Kohen? The Gemara says, Kasha, indeed this seems to be a problem, and there's no obvious answer to this question. The Mishnah then said that HaKarkos Tisha V'Kohen. When it comes to appraising consecrated land for the purpose of redeeming it, you need 10 people, one of whom must be a Kohen. So 9 people that don't have to be a Kohen, and the 10th person has to be a Kohen. The Gemara asks, Minahani Mili, from where do we know these words? What is the source for this halacha? So the Gemara explains, Amar Shmuel, the source is because Asara Kohanim Ksuvin Beparsha. The Torah actually mentions the word Kohen 10 times in the passage that deals with redeeming consecrated land. And the number 10 in the passage is the source that 10 people are required. But seemingly, if it says a Kohen every single time, doesn't that mean that all 10 of them have to be a Kohen? Shmuel explains that no, it does not mean that. If there are rules as to how to interpret psukim, and interpret when the Torah uses an exclusionary term, here's how those rules apply in this instance. Chad, the first time the Torah mentions exclusive term Kohen, it can't just be any person, he has to be a Kohen, this person appraising the consecrated land. The first time Kohen is mentioned is needed legufe. It's needed for itself, it is. First time the Torah says the word Kohen, the Torah is simply conveying the information that only a Kohen could do this and not a different person, not a non-Kohen. It excludes a Yisrael. But then the Torah says this exclusionary term again and again and again, another 9 times. So says Shmuel, the Torah repeats the exclusionary term Kohen, Hanech, these other times the Torah uses this term, that becomes Havi Miut Acher Miut. We have here an exclusion that follows an exclusion. Like, you already told me that he can't be Yisrael. Why are you telling me again? The rule in such a case is, Vein miyot achar miyot ela l'rabos. The way we interpret a repeated exclusionary term is that, as counterintuitive as it may sound, the Torah is actually coming to include when that exclusion is repeated. So in effect, each time the Torah repeats the word Kohen again and again, another 9 times, the Torah actually means is to include, to expand the eligibility to appraise the consecrated karka to even a non-Kohen, so that in the end, after these 9 repetitions, we have the Afilu Tes Yisrael V'Yachid Kohen. And of these 10 people, even 9 of them may be a Yisrael, don't have to be a Kohen, one of them must be a Kohen. But the Gemara has a question on this, which is, Maskif lo Rav Huna Bereder of Nasan, Huna the son of Rav Nasan, questions Shmuel's interpretation of the passage. He says, 1 minute here, I hear what you're saying, Shmuel, that as far as, let's say, the second time the Torah says the word Kohen, it seems correct to say that, hey, you already excluded a non-Kohen. Why are you excluding a non-Kohen again? So it's an exclusion after an exclusion, which equals an inclusion. Which means that now the Torah is saying that the appraisers do not have to be Kohanim. So I would assume, whatever number of appraisers you ultimately need, none of them except for one needs to be a Kohen. So that now the next time the Torah uses the word Kohen, how should we interpret that? We should interpret that as a regular old exclusion. That is, the Torah is saying that no, for this next appraiser, he does need to be a Kohen. So that the Torah is saying that at least 2 of the appraisers need to be Kohanim. Then the Torah says Kohen again, a 4th time. So then true, fine. It's an exclusion after an exclusion, which equals an inclusion. So the Torah is saying this next appraiser can be a Yisrael. But now that, again, we're in inclusion mode, the following time the Torah says Kohen, the 5th time, that should be interpreted as a regular old exclusion. As you thought that the rest of the people could be Yisraelim, says the Torah, no, the next one must be a Kohen. And you repeat this process until you get to number 10, so that in the end, Ema, we should say, we should read it like this, and therefore the end result should be Chamisha Kohanim v'Chamisha Yisraelim. As we alternate each time between regular miyut and miyut achar miyut, the final halacha should be that Torah says, okay, 5 of these people, it's okay to be Yisrael, but the other 5 must be Kohanim. Seemingly, that's how we should have to interpret the passage. The Gemara says, Kash, indeed, this is a valid question. There's no obvious answer to this question. The Mishnah then said, V'adam ki yotze bahen. And similarly, like just like we said in the case of consecrated land, you need 10 appraisers, so too in the case of a consecrated person. The Gemara asks, Adam mi kadosh, can a person, we're assuming they're referring, Adam refers to a free person, regular Jewish person. So the Gemara asks, can a person become consecrated? No, can't consecrate a regular person. So what could the Mishnah be referring to? The Gemara answers, I'm Rabbi Avahu. Avahu explains. The Mishnah is talking about a case, Be'omer domai olai. A person got up one day and said, my market value, whatever my market value is, the definition of that is how much would he sell as a slave, if he were to be sold as a slave, that amount is upon me to donate to the Beis HaMikdash. Indeed, if a person made such a pledge, we would go and assess that person, he would be appraised, based on how much he would be worth on the slave market. The Tanya, as it says in the Braisa, HaOmer Domai Olai, somebody said this, I hereby pledge my value to the Beis HaMikdash, Shamin Osoke Evet Animchar B'Shuk. We evaluate him by considering, okay, how much would he sell for if he were Evet Kanani being sold on the slave market. So that's the appraisal process the Mishnah refers to here. And the Mishnah rules, you need 10 experts, 10 appraisers to be involved in this process. Why? Ve'eved iskash lekarkos. Since an Eved Kanani is scripturally compared to land. Torah compares slaves to land, their legal status is similar to the legal status of land. And so if the process here is, we ask, well, how much would this person sell for if he were an Eved Kanani? Well, the halacha is, if an Eved Kanani was, let's say, consecrated, given to the Beis HaMikdash, and then you want to redeem him, to assess him, you would require 10 people because slaves are compared to land. So same thing in this case. Of this free person, if we need to appraise him as if he was an Eved Kanani, okay, that means we've got to appraise him with 10 people. That's what the Mishnah is teaching us. The Gemara has a related question now. Rabbi Yovin asked, what would be the halacha if somebody went ahead and consecrated? He said, this is donated to the Beis HaMikdash, Sar HaOmed Ligzos. Somebody's hair. Now we have to be talking about his slave, his Eved Kanani, who is legally considered his property. So the master went ahead and consecrated his slave's hair. Now the hair was Omed Ligzos. It was ready to be cut. It was at a length where normally people would cut the hair that reaches that length. Question is, in such a case, how many people are required to appraise the hair that he consecrated? The question here comes down to, do we say, Kegozus dami ubishlosha? Since, you know, come on, it's getting really long, it's ready to be cut. Halachically, legally, it's considered as if it was cut already. And as such, if we're viewing the hair as if it was separated from the person, then of course it's not considered, you know, like land, it's a freestanding, it's a movable thing. Hence, you only need 3 to appraise it. Oh, kumachuber dami basaro, perhaps, since it's physically still attached to the person, it's part of the person. As we said above, the status of an Eved Kanani is like that of land, and so when you're dealing with the redeeming consecrated land, you need 10 people to appraise it. So how many are needed to appraise this hair? The Gemara answers, Toshma, come in here. A Braisa which discusses this question. Says the Braisa, Hamagdish es avdo. First opinion, the Braisa says, if somebody consecrated, donated his slave to the Beis HaMikdash, ein moal in bo. Although the slave is consecrated, he's now property of the Beis HaMikdash, however, the specific law of Me'ilah, which is a particular prohibition that says most objects that have been consecrated to the Beis HaMikdash, is a very serious prohibition if somebody inadvertently uses that object for himself for personal benefit. He has to pay back the principal plus a fifth, and he has to bring a carbon asham. Says the first opinion, the law of Me'ilah does not apply to a slave. Because of what we said earlier, slaves are compared to land, and the halacha is, a consecrated land is not subject to Me'ilah. So if land is not subject to the law of Me'ilah, neither is a slave. And the Braisa continues, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer mo'alin b'saro. Says Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, I basically agree with you, that as far as the basic person, this slave himself, there's no law of Me'ilah. Everybody agrees about that. But says Rabbi Shimon Liel, as far as the slave's hair, I say there is a law, a status of Me'ilah on that hair. Now, v'kai melon, we've established that the b'saro ha'omed ligzos pligi, the case that these opinions are arguing about is where this hair is ready to be cut. It's very long. It's past the length where people normally would get a haircut. And so that means that these Tanaim are arguing about the exact question that Rabbi Yovin raised above. They're arguing about, do we say that since it's ready to be cut, therefore it's considered separate, it's metatlim, and therefore would have a law of Me'ilah like any other metatlim that were consecrated? So that's Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion. Tanakama, however, who apparently says across the board, even this hair has no law of Me'ilah, he's understanding that even though it's ready to be cut, it's very long, still, since it's physically attached, it's considered part of the Eved, and since the Eved has no law of Me'ilah, neither does his hair. Shema Minah, indeed, so we learn from here that the Tanaim already disputed this question that Rabbi Yovin asked. The Gemara now suggests, Nei Mahani Tanoi Kahani Tanoi. The Gemara suggests to make a connection between the dispute of Tanaim that we just learned with the following dispute of Tanaim, the Tanan, the Mishnah in Shavuos, which discusses, Shavuos, of course, is about oaths. And halacha is, there's no law, you never make an oath. The court would not make a person swear in a case involving land. So for example, if there was a dispute in court where the defendant partially admitted a monetary case having to do with land, even though in general there is a halacha of moda b'miktsa satayna, the Torah says if the defendant partially admits to the plaintiff's claim that he then has to take an oath and swear about the part that he is denying. However, that halacha does not apply by land. This is derived from the pasuk. So the Mishnah Shavuos discusses the following: Rabbi Meir Omer, Yesh Dvarim Shehein Kikarka Ve'einen Kikarka. You could have a case where there's something that, at least physically, seems to be part of the land. It's physically attached to the land, and yet halachically, it's not judged as part of the land, and therefore the oath would apply. Ve'ein Chachamim Modim La. But the Chachamim do not agree with Rabbi Meir on this halacha that he's saying. Okay, so what's the case here? The case is, for example, let's say Reuven comes over to Shimon and says, he claims, Eser Gefanim Te'unos Masarti Lach. He says, hey Shimon, I entrusted you with my 10 vines, which are Te'unos, which are laden, you know, carrying grapes on them. They had fruit on them, growing on them. The other one, Shimon says, nah, there are only 5. You give me 5, not 10. So in other words, he partially admits to the plaintiff's claim, Rabbi Meir Mechayev. Rabbi Meir holds Shimon liable to swear about the 5 that he is denying. The Chachamim and the Chacham say, no, no shvua here. Because, kol ha-mechuber lekarka, rehu kekarka. Anything that's physically attached to the land in question is judged as part of the land. And the rule again is, there's no oaths by land, so there's no oath here. Now, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina further explained about this dispute. There's only dispute because we're talking about a case where the grapes in question are ready to be harvested. They're ready to be picked off the vines. In such a case, we have the following dispute. One opinion, the opinion of Rabbi Meir, holds, we treat the grapes as if they were picked. They may be physically attached, but legally they're looked at as separate from the vines, and therefore the chiyav to swear applies. Whereas Umar Sover Lav Kivitsuras Damyan. Chacham, on the other hand, hold that even though they're ready to be picked, doesn't matter, they're physically growing on the vines, they're still judged as part of the vines, part of the land, and therefore there's no oath. So the Gemara suggests that this dispute parallels the above dispute between Rabbi Gamliel and the Rabbanan. In other words, seemingly Rabbi Meir would also apply his opinion about the vines to the case of the hair. Since the hair is ready to be cut, legally it's viewed as if it was cut, and therefore there would be no law of Me'ilah. But the Gemara responds, lo, not necessarily. Says the Gemara, afilu tema Rabbi Meir. It's entirely possible that Rabbi Meir would agree with the view of the Rabbanan, who argued against Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that the slave's hair is considered part of the slave. This is no Me'ilah. What's the difference? For it can look on Rabbi Meir Hassam. All we see in this mission Shavuos there is that Rabbi Meir is saying that the grapes which are ready to be harvested are considered separate from the vines. There is a clear argument to make for that position, since kol kama deshavka lehu mikchash kachshi. Once the grapes are ready to be harvested, if you just leave them there without picking them, they're going to get worse. The quality of the grapes is going to deteriorate. So it's specifically bad for the grapes to leave them attached to the vines once they're ready to be picked. So it could be fine. In that case, Rabbi Meir says, that since the grapes are not benefiting at all by being physically attached to the vines, halachically we view the grapes as separate from the vines of Osara, but in the case of the slave's hair, true, it's getting nice and long, and people start making comments, hey, your hair is pretty long, it's time for a haircut. No, won't you say? But the fact is, in terms of the physical state of the hair itself, kol kama deshavkalu ish buchi mashbach. There is no question that the hair is improved. It does better. It is growing by virtue of being attached to the slave's head. So perhaps in that case, Rabbi Meir would agree with the Chachamim, with the Rabbanan of above, that we view the hair as part of the Eved, and if it's part of the Eved, it's considered like land, and therefore there's no law of Me'ilah. Our Mishnah then went on to teach that when it comes to Dinei Nefashos, capital cases, we need a Sanhedrin of 23 judges. And then the Mishnah discussed this specific capital case where a behema was either rova, a person, a behema, an animal, sodomized the person, and the point is the person allowed this, he voluntarily involved himself in this act of bestiality. Or the other way, if a person sodomized an animal, then that act of bestiality is subject to the death penalty and hence requires a court of 23 judges. The Gemara points out about the Mishnah's language that Kepasik Vitani, the Mishnah's categorical language, implies that Loshna Roveya Zachar Veloshna Roveya Nekeva. Whether this animal sodomized a male or a female, Mishnah doesn't specify either way, so the implication is that either way, this halacha would apply that the animal, when being judged, being sentenced to death, would have to be judged by a court of 23 judges. It's again obvious that the person would have to be judged by 23 judges because you're talking about a capital case. The Mishnah is saying that even the animal needs to be judged by 23 judges, again, whether it sodomized a man or a woman. The Gemara says, Bishlama Raveya Nikeva. We understand the Mishnah's basis when it comes to the animal sodomizing a woman, the Chsiv. But the Pasuk says, in Parshas Kedoshim, the Torah says very clearly, V'harakta Isaisha V'yasa Behema. The Pasuk begins there by clearly discussing a case where the animal sodomized the woman, says the Torah. You shall kill the woman and the animal. And so the Pasuk here is comparing the judgment of the woman and the animal. So just as the woman is judged by a court of 23, so too the animal. The Gemara wonders, though, the Reveh Zachar Minolan, from where do we know that the same law of requirement of a court of 23 applies in the case where the animal sodomized a male, a man? The Gemara answers, we learn this point from the Pasuk in Mishpatim, Nechsev. Pasuk in Mishpatim writes, Kol shochev im behema mos yumas. Anyone who lies with an animal, commits an act of bestiality, shall surely be put to death. The problem with this pasuk is that the Torah in Kedoshim already says that bestiality is forbidden. A man cannot commit bestiality, which would make this pasuk redundant. Therefore, this is a situation where we can apply the Jerusha principle of an imenu inyan, which in our case says as follows. Imenu inyan l'shochev, if we're not to apply the pasuk to the case of what the literal words describe of a man sodomizing an animal, we can't apply the pasuk to that case because, again, the Torah already taught us that. Therefore, teneu inyan lenishkav. Apply the pasuk to be referring to a case where a man allowed himself to be sodomized by an animal. The Torah teaches that even in that situation, the person is subject to the death penalty. At the same time, we're not ignoring the fact that the way the Torah expressed this halacha was by referring to a case where the man sodomized the animal. The Gemara says, what does that teach us? The reason the Torah expressed this halacha of the man being sodomized with the language of a man sodomizing the animal is in order is to teach us to compare the two cases, to compare the case where he was sodomized to where he is sodomized. It is mash shochev hu behemto be'esrim mushlosha. Just as the Torah makes it clear in Parshas Kedoshim that in the case where he sodomized the animal, that both he and the animal are put to death, and meaning since the Torah says those two right next to each other, it means in the same manner with the court of 23. Av nishkav hu behemto be'esrim mushlosha. Same halacha applies when he was sodomized by the animal. I mean, he allowed himself to do that just as he would be judged by a court of 23 because it's a capital case on a human being. So too the animal. The animal must be judged. In order to give it the death penalty, has to be judged by a Sanhedrin of 23. The Mishnah then taught that Shor HaNiskal Be'asur Mishlosha, the ox that has to be stoned to death because it killed a person, is judged also by a court of 23. The Mishnah said, how do we know? Shenemar, for the Pasuk in Mishpatim says, Hashor Yisakel, Lishor is stoned to death, Vigam Be'alav Yumas. And also the ox's owner, who was negligent here and allowed his ox to kill a person, is put to death. What is the purpose of mentioning the owner being put to death right next to his ox being put to death? It's to teach us that K'misas HaBailim Kach Misas HaShor. Same way that we put the owner to death, of course, if it's a human being judged, with a capital case, and we need 23 judges, so too by the ox itself, the Shor HaNiskal requires a court of 23 judges as well. The Gemara studies the Mishnah's derivation from the Pasuk. Amar le Abaye le Rava, Abaye said to Rava, he asked on the Mishnah's source, Mimai dehai v'gam bi'alav yumas. Who says that this phrase in the Pasuk, and also the owner shall be put to death, is l'kemisas b'alim kach misas hashar, with the ox is coming to convey this point. They were supposed to compare the process of putting the ox to death to the way we would put the owner to death, i.e. through a court of 23 judges. Who says that's what the pasuk is coming to say? Turning to Amud Beis, Eima l'ktalahu da'asa. Why not simply understand that the Torah here wants to teach us what the literal words seem to say, that is, the Torah adds a halacha, that the owner is also put to death. Not only is the actual ox to kill the person put to death, but even its owner is put to death. Now Tosis goes into a whole explanation as to why these two interpretations are mutually exclusive. That is, why can't both be true? As maybe you're right, Abaye. The Torah literally means that the owner is put to death, and by placing that next to the death penalty on the ox, the Torah is saying that they both need a quart of 23. The Torah explains how, you know, based on this specific language of the pasuk, if the correct interpretation of this pasuk really was that the Torah wants to actually put the owner to death, and Tosis explains why there would not be room here to make any comparison. Rather, it is only because, as we'll see, ultimately we don't interpret the pasuk literally. The Torah is not literally saying that the owner is put to death. Therefore, what is the Torah saying? What is the purpose of this phrase that mentions the death penalty by people, by person? It is only to compare death penalty of a person to the animal, that just like when trying a person in a capital case, you need 23 judges, so too the court case for this ox needs 23 judges. So basically, who says that's true? Maybe the pasuk is simply imposing the actual death penalty on the ox's owner for failing to prevent the ox from killing a person. Rava responds, in Cain, as if that were so, if the Torah's purpose here was to actually impose the death penalty on the ox's owner, lichto v'gam bi'alav v'lishtok. The pasuk should have simply written the words, you know, after saying that the ox is put to death, and also its owner. And the point would then be clear that the owner is also put to death. The Balishta could then be silent, say nothing further. The fact that the Torah added the seemingly superfluous word yumas signals to us that we're not to read this literally. Rather, the whole thing is a drasha. It's to make the point that the way, the process of putting the ox to death is the same process as it would be if we were to put the owner to death. That is, just as whenever you're putting a human being, you're judging a human being for the death penalty, you have to have a quart of 23, so too by the ox. But not that the Torah is actually saying that, you know, here in this particular case, that the owner is subject to the death penalty. But Abaye responds to this. He says, what do you mean the word you must, that he shall be put to death, is superfluous? Says Abaye, not true. Because of Rachmanachi, if the Torah said it the way you proposed, it's just v'gam ba'alav, and omitted the word yumas, havi amina b'skila, I would have said, okay, you know, let's pretend we're in the hypothetical world that the Torah is literally saying that the ox's owner is also put to death. If the Torah simply said, and also the owner, I'd presume that the owner receives the same specific death penalty as the ox receives, namely, death through stoning. So says Abaye, you know why the pasuk had to add the word yumas, shall be put to death, in order to clarify, not like our assumption, to teach us that in fact the ox's owner receives the typical death penalty whenever the Torah simply says this person shall be put to death. The presumption is it refers to chenek, to death by strangulation. So therefore Abaye says that, you know, in my world, in my proposal, there is a purpose of the word yumas, and so again there's no basis here seemingly to depart from the literal interpretation. Nothing to do with talking about the quart of 23 for the ox, a comparison. No, it's simply saying, it's literally teaching that the ox's owner is also put to death through chenek. But Rava responds to this. He says, no, I would never have said such a thing. You don't need yumas to tell me, don't say, give the ox's owner death through stoning. V'skila sakadaitach. Could you have ever thought that the Torah puts the ox's owner to death through skila? Says Rava, that's inconceivable. For katal ihu b'sayif. You're telling me I would have thought that the halacha is, if a person actually kills, he commits murder, what does the Torah say? And the murderer receives the death penalty through sayef, through the sword, he's beheaded by a sword, which is a more lenient type of death penalty than the death penalty of skila, and yet somehow we would think that mimono b'skila, in this situation where he, of course, did not himself kill with his own hands. He was just negligent, and he failed to prevent his ox from killing a person. And yet the Torah would impose a more severe death penalty for this negligence than the act of, you know, literally murdering a person with his own hands? It's inconceivable. You never think such a thing. So Rava says you don't need yumas for that. So we go back to that yumas seems superfluous. Must be that yumas is telling me don't interpret this literally. We're just sticking in. We're mentioning the halacha of a person being given the death penalty to compare the ox's death penalty to that to require the court of 23 judges. But Abaye persists here at modifying his challenge. He says, no, what do you mean? I'll tell you, v'dil mahay de kasav rachamana yumas la'akule lave. It's possible that the purpose of this word yumas is not for what you're saying, not to make it a court of 23, but rather the Torah here is downgrading the level of death penalty for the ox's owner. That is, really the ox's owner is put to death. The word yumas downgrades, you know, gives a more lenient death penalty than we would have otherwise assumed. That is, if the Torah said nothing, I would assume that, like, the Torah considers it like the ox's owner, like, essentially murdered this person by failing to stop his ox from doing that. So we would assume the owner gets saif, death through the sword, he's beheaded by a sword. So comes along the Torah and says, you must. Again, if the Torah simply says, you must, the presumption is the other death penalty of chenek, strangulation. So the point is, you must comes, la fuke mi saif lechenek, to exclude from, to downgrade, to go lighter on the punishment here, to go from death through the sword to death by strangulation. The Torah is coming to be lenient, so that is an understandable point that the Torah would have to make. We would have thought he gets a severe one. The Torah comes to say, no, he gets a lighter one because, you know, the fact is he didn't murder the person with his own hands. It was his ox. And the Gemara qualifies the question by acknowledging that ha nicha lemandiyamar chenek chamur. The truth is, this is not a question if we assume, like, the opinion. It's a disagreement about this issue. There's one opinion that says that the death penalty of strangulation is actually more severe. That's a more severe, worse kind of a death penalty than death penalty through the sword, beheading by a sword. According to that position, Abaye has no question here, because it wouldn't make sense to suggest that the Torah here is telling us, just like we asked above, it can't be the Torah would be saying that, you know, again, the starting point is that the owner, if he's really put to death, he's killed through saif, through the sword. It would not make sense to understand that the Torah, with the word yumas, again, yumas means chenek, the Torah is coming to say the owner of the ox gets a worse death penalty than if he had murdered the person with his own hands. That doesn't make sense. So according to the opinion that indeed chenek is worse than saif, then, you know, this reading doesn't work, and therefore we'll have to say, like Rava, that yumas tells me that we're not really giving him the death penalty, we're just teaching the comparison to require a court of 23 for the ox. However, according to the other opinion, though, there's another opinion that says that death by strangulation is a more lenient kind of death penalty than death through saif, through the sword. What are we going to say in defense of Rava? That is, Abaye seems to have a very valid question. If you assume, like, that opinion, that again, we are able to read the pasuk literally, we can read it literally. The Torah is saying that you put the ox's owner to death too. And the word yumas is saying that we don't quite give him the regular death penalty for a regular case of murder, like where he murdered him, which would be death through a scythe, through the sword. No, in this case, since he himself didn't do it, he gets the death penalty through chenek. So it's a way to read the pasuk literally. And you don't have Rava's drasha then, that the whole point here is to compare the ox to the person, and so we would not have a source that for the ox we need a court of 23. Rava responds to this latest modified proposal of Abaye, lo sagadaitach, you can't think such a thing. It's simply out of the question that the Torah literally means here to put the owner of the ox to death as well. For the chsiv, for the pasig writes, regarding this case where this person's ox killed, says the Torah, im kofer yusha salaf. If the owner pays a kofer, he pays an atonement payment, then that, like, will redeem him. That is, like, part of the punishment here. The owner of the ox has to pay this kofer payment. So Rava points out, v'isag adaitach barkot lohu. If you say, like my colleague Abaye, that the Torah in the previous pasuk really meant to place the death penalty on the ox's owner, and this notion of paying a kofer payment doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit. For v'haksiv, for the Torah says, in Parshas Maaseh, when the Torah is talking about a person who himself murdered a person, lo sikhu chofer lenefesh rotzeach, he can't accept some payment from the murderer. No, he's put to death. So seemingly the Torah is saying that if somebody is really liable to the death penalty, as is certainly the case where a person actually committed murder, says the Torah, there's no such thing as making a chofer payment. So Rava says, must be, in our case, where the person's ox killed the person, and the Torah does discuss the option of making a payment, that when the Torah said earlier, implied, it sounded like it was saying that the owner's put to death, doesn't mean that. So must be, it's saying, the word yumas is telling us that we're discussing putting a person to death, giving a person a death penalty next to this halacha, putting the ox to death, to teach us that just like a person, by Dina Nefashis, we need 23 judges, so too by the ox. The Gemara responds to this, Abai says back, Adarabba, just the opposite. Mishum hi gufa. The very point that you bring up, Rav, is exactly why the Torah had to specifically teach us, in the case where his ox kills a person, that we do accept the kofar payment. That is, as you correctly point out, Rava, the Torah says that if a person directly with his own hands murders a person, you put the person to death and you don't accept any payment. There's no option of redeeming himself through a payment. However, in our case, where his ox killed a person, the Torah is teaching us that that's not the halacha. It is. Rabbi says, katal iyo, if the person himself kills a person, there the Torah says, lo tisagi le b'mamona ela b'katala. Not enough. Justice is not served if he gives some payment. Rather, he must be put to death. However, the Torah here tells us, kot l'shoro, if his ox killed a person, although that crime that he failed to stop his ox from killing a person warrants the death penalty on the owner as well, says the Torah, lifrok nafshe b'memona. He may redeem himself with a payment. The Torah is recognizing that the problem that he failed to stop his ox from killing a person is not the same as the crime of actually committing murder. And therefore, it says the Torah, he may redeem himself from this death penalty if he gives the kofar payment. And so, Abai's question seems to remain here, that what's the basis to take the word yumas and say it's here for the comparison to teach that the ox also needs 23 judges? No. Read it literally. The Torah says that we put the owner to death. That is, the starting point is the owner of this ox that killed is liable to the death penalty. Unless he makes a payment, then he redeems himself. So seemingly, you still have no source, Rava. But the Gemara now finally puts Abai's question to rest. Ella Amr Chizkiya. Rather, Chizkiya said, V'chein tana de Bei Chizkiya, and it was also taught in the Braisa of Bei Chizkiya, that Amr Kra, the Pasuk in Maaseh says, Mos Yumas Hamake Rotzeach Hu. The Torah says about a murderer, he shall surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. With this language, the Pasuk is teaching us that al ritzichaso atahargo. His act of murder, he's put to death, v'yatahargo al ritzichashoro. There is no death penalty in a case where his ox killed a person, which therefore precludes Abai's reading. We therefore say it can't be when the Torah says, v'gam ba'alav you must, the Torah is saying that there's literally a death penalty on the ox's owner. Rather, Yumas is coming to create this hekesh to compare the general halacha of a person being put to death to this case of the Sharniskal being put to death. It is, just like by a person you need 23 judges, so too by this Sharniskal, the court has to be comprised of a court of 23 judges. The Gemara wonders about another case where an ox could be put to death, and that is Ibailu, they asked, Shor Sinai Bekamo. If an ox overstepped the boundary by Har Sinai, it is when the Torah was given, God instructed, V'gibalta es ha'am saviv. You must make a boundary around Har Sinai. The people can't come too close to it on pain of death through stoning. And the Pasuk clearly says, Im behema, im ish lo yichya. Whether it's an ish, whether it's a man or a behema. If a beast crosses that line, getting too close to Har Sinai, then the shor shall be put to death. One wonders if that happened, there's no practical relevance today, but let's say Shor then crossed the line and now is liable to the death penalty, would they in the Midbar have to have assembled a court of 23 judges? Question is, Mi gomer shah mi doros olo. Do we extrapolate a law that applies, of course, for a temporary period? This is a law that applied specifically by Matan Torah. So it's shah, it's a temporary thing. Would you extrapolate the law for a temporary period from Doros, from laws that apply for all generations, like the laws we said above, that a shor that kills a person or is involved in an act of bestiality is put to death only through a court of 23? Do we extrapolate or not? The Gemara answers, Toshima, come in here and answer to your question. The Tani Rami Bar Yecheskel, Rami Bar Yecheskel taught a braisa that quotes our pasagim behema yimish lo yichya. The Torah says, a beast or man that goes over the line, approaches Har Sinai, shall be put to death. Sir Mecheskel's Brisa says, the Torah here is comparing the law of the behemoth to the law of the ish. That is, ma ish b'chav gimel, just as presumably, even back then in the Midbar, we already had the Sanhedrin set up through Yisrael. So presumably, the same halacha that our Mishnah said, that dina nefashos, any capital case, requires a court of 23, af behema b'chav gimel. So too, the Torah is saying here, by juxtaposing behemoth ish, that for the behemoth's death penalty too, if a behemoth would have went over the line, they would have required a court of 23 judges. The Mishnah continued that this halacha of shor niskal, the dangerous shor that killed the person, that a court of 23 judges is required to put it to death, is not only by a shor niskal, not only by an ox, but other dangerous animals as well. Hariv, a zev, like a lion or a wolf, and the Mishnah lists other dangerous animals like a snake. If they kill the person, they can only be put to death through a Sanhedrin of 23 judges. But then the Mishnah brought the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, Kala Kodim, Lahargan, Zacha. Eliezer says, whoever gets up himself, whoever is first to kill one of these dangerous animals is Zacha. He got the schus he gained by being the first one to kill that animal. So clearly disagreeing with the first opinion. But there's two ways to interpret exactly what Eliezer is saying, which the Gemara discusses now. Amrei Shlakish, Shlakish explains that Eliezer is not, you know, so far apart from the first opinion in that Vehushe Misu. Eliezer agrees with the Tanakhama that we're talking about a case where this dangerous animal, the lion, snake, whatever it was, did kill a person. Eliezer is saying, once the animal killed a person, then you don't need a court of 23. Anybody who gets up and kills the animal, that's great. Ah, Veloy Misu, but if any of the animals listed did not actually kill a person, lo. Eliezer is not saying that you'd be allowed, that there's some mitzvah you're supposed to go and kill the animal. No, not true. The Gemara observes, that means that Alma we see, Kesavah, the Rish Lakish holds, Yesh Lohen Tarbus, V'yesh Lohen Bailam. That even these, you know, by nature, you know, dangerous animals, they could be tamed, and consequently, there is a legitimate concept of ownership, even by such, you know, typically dangerous animals. So therefore, it's someone's property, and therefore we'll assume that he tamed, he trained the animal. It's not a dangerous thing, so he owns it. He can't go and kill somebody's, you know, destroy someone's property. It's only if, you know, if an animal kills, then the animal forfeits his life. If he killed a person, clearly it was not tamed, and therefore, kolakotim lahargan zacha, we would appreciate anybody who can get up and kill this animal. Whoever is first, that's great. That's Rish Lakish's understanding of Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. However, Rabbi Yochanan Omar, Rabbi Yochanan says, Eliezer means to say even further that afal pisha lo himisu, even if this lion or tiger or bear, whatever it was, did not kill anyone, it's still appropriate, it's proper to go ahead and kill that animal, even if there's supposedly an owner. He says, oh no, don't worry, this one's not going to hurt anybody. He says, Eliezer, go and kill it. But we see that Kesavah Rabbi Yochanan holds that ein lahen tarbus ve'ein lahen bailam. Yochanan understands that in Eliezer's opinion, at least, it's simply impossible to tame these dangerous animals, and therefore there is no concept of ownership by these animals. You're not allowed to own these animals. And therefore Eliezer says, go ahead and kill it, even if there was no occurrence that the animal actually did anything dangerous, that it killed anybody. The Gemara questions Rish Lakish's understanding from the wording in our Mishnah. Not. Our Mishnah brought Eliezer's opinion. Here's what Eliezer said. Eliezer Omer, Kol HaKodem Lahargan Zacha. Eliezer's language was, whoever's first to kill one of these dangerous animals is Zacha. Now, Zacha implies the person has gained something. He is Zacha, he merited, he gained something by killing the animal. Like, first come, first serve. So, Bishlam Rabbi Yochanan. I understand this language according to Rabbi Yochanan. Lamai Zacha. What does the person gain? He does gain something very tangible, which is Zacha Le'oran. He gains, he gets to keep the hide of this animal. Because again, Rabbi Yochanan said, and there's no concept of owning one of these dangerous animals. So the animal is considered hefker, it's considered ownerless. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, the reading of the Mishnah is beautiful. You have this ownerless animal walking around, so anybody wants to kill it and keep its hide. So that's what it means, zacha. Whoever's first to kill it gets to keep that hide, because nobody is considered a legitimate owner of such a dangerous animal. But according to Rish Lakish, that no, there is an owner of this animal, just that the death penalty is activated if it kills a person, and Eliezer says, you don't need to do the death penalty through the court. The problem is, according to that understanding, Lamai Zacha, what could that mean, that the person who kills it is Zacha, he gains something, he can get something out of this if he kills the animal? Problem is, Kivin Shei Misu, since again, we're talking where this animal actually murdered a person. So now, normally, we'd have to go to court, and through the court, the judges would sentence it to death. However, we're saying, no, you could do extrajudicial killing, just kill the animal. But the fact is, we're now talking about a case where the halacha is saying, you know, really, in theory, it should need a due process. It should go through the courts. But Shavinu Rabbanan command the Gomer Dinayu. The Rabbanan apparently consider this animal as if we say, okay, it's as if it already went through the court. But the bottom line is that this person who kills the animal is really acting as the court's executioner, just that we don't actually require to go through the court. But he's really executing the animal on behalf of the court. So the problem is, if you have an animal, just like the regular Shor Niskal case, where the court puts it to death because it killed the person, v'yisuri hananinu, any such animal becomes completely forbidden for any benefit. If an animal killed the person and the court puts it to death, or in this case, we're allowing this citizen to get up and put it to death for the court, halacha is that killed animal is completely forbidden for any benefit. So it's hard to understand. What does it mean, zacha? What does he get out of it? He can't keep the hide. The hide is also for benefit. The Gemara answers, for Reish Lakish, my zacha. What does the Mishnah mean, zacha? According to Reish Lakish, zacha l'shamayim. He gained like a mitzvah. He gained favor in the eyes of heaven that he did a very proper thing by killing this dangerous animal that actually killed a person. And the Gemara now says, Tanya Kavuse the Reish Lakish is a brisa. The following brisa actually supports Reish Lakish's understanding. It says this brisa, Echad shor shehemis v'echad behema v'chaya shehemisu. Whatever the animal was, whether it was an ox or any other animal that killed a person, halacha is b'chaf gimel. Says the first opinion, we require a court of 23 judges. However, Rabbi Eliezer says, shor shehemis v'esem shlosha. Since the Torah specifically tells us this by an ox, fine, an ox that's put to death, that killed the person, you need a court of 23 judges. But Ushar, Behema, V'chaya, Shehemisu, any other animal, though, that killed the person, says that killed the person, the halacha is, Kol HaKodem Lehargan Zacha Bahen LaShemayim. Whoever gets up and does the mitzvah of killing that animal that killed a person, is Zacha LaShemayim, he gains a mitzvah, and from Shemayim, he's rewarded by heaven. So the Braisa clearly presents Rabbi Eliezer's opinion exactly as Reish Lakish explained it. The Mishnah then continued with the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. The Mishnah said Rabbi Akiva says that no, all these animals, the wild animals as well, not just the shor, can only be sentenced to death by a court of 23. The Gemara asks that seemingly Rabbi Akiva, Hainu Tanakama. Rabbi Akiva's opinion seems to be identical with the first opinion. That's what the first opinion said. That it's not only Shor Niskal, but any animal that kills needs a court of 23. So what's the difference between the first opinion and Rabbi Akiva? The Gemara answers, Ika Beinayu Nachash. The difference between the first opinion and Rabbi Akiva is the halacha by snake that kills. That is, the first opinion you explicitly mentioned snake in his list of animals that also requires a court of 23. Holds clearly that the snake also needs a court of 23. Rabbi Akiva, who just, you know, says it in a more general way, that even these animals listed above require a court of 23, he's saying that I agree that in the case of almost all of these animals, you need a court of 23, except for the most dangerous one of all, the snake. There, Rabbi Akiva makes an exception, and he says that no judicial process is required. The first one to kill it is Zacha. The Mishnah then taught Halacha that we would not judge a whole tribe of Bnei Yisrael except with the Sanhedrin HaGadol, Supreme Sanhedrin of 71 judges. The question is, what exactly is the case here of the whole tribe doing a sin? Hai Shevet Dechata B'mai. The Gemara asks, what happened here exactly? What sin did the whole tribe do in the Mishnah's case? We're saying you need the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Ilema Shevet Shechila L'sa Shabbos. If you suggest that it's a case where an entire tribe was Mechal Shabbos, so maybe the Mishnah is saying in that case, you can't just use a regular minor Sanhedrin of 23 judges. No, you need the Sanhedrin HaGadol of 71 judges. The problem is, there's no basis for such a distinction. For Eimar de Polig Rachmana ben Yechidim lemerubin, where do we find the Torah distinguishing between an individual sinner versus, you know, a larger population of sinners who all partook in this one sin? Le'inyan Avodas Kacham. The only case where we find that is regarding the sin of Avodah Zarah. They worshipped an idol. Of course, the Torah says there's something called Irani Dachas, which means that if the whole city went wayward and served Avodah Zarah, did idol worship, then a regular Sanhedrin of 23 is not enough. You have to use the Sanhedrin HaGadol. However, Bishar Mitzvahs Mipalig, any other prohibition, any other Avera, is there any, do we find a distinction between a case where an individual did the sin or a bunch of people did the sin. We don't find any such distinction. So that can't be the case of the Mishnah. So must be the Mishnah is specifically referring to where the entire tribe went wayward, went off and served Avodah Zarah. So Mishnah is saying in that case he needs Nezhen HaGadol, 71 judges of Lishka Sagazis to judge that case. But the Gemara still has a problem, which is Lememra the Bedina the Rabbim Dainina Lay. But is this so? Is it true that when an entire tribe does Avodah Zarah, then now that group of people gets a status, a judgment of Yerni Dachas, which requires 71 judges, the Sanhedrin, a Gadol. But the problem is, come on, of the known opinions, which opinion could such a ruling follow? It doesn't seem to fit with either opinion. It is Loka Rabbi Yosha, but Loka Rabbi Yonasan doesn't fit with Rabbi Yosha or Rabbi Yonasan, as we will now see, the Tanya. For it teaches in the Braisa, Ad Kama Osin Yerni Dachas. What are the numbers exactly that constitute Yerni Dachas, which has this a different set of laws, the type of death penalty, and the property has to be destroyed, and you have to use Sanhedrin HaGadol, not just the Sanhedrin of 23. How many people would fall under this halacha of Yerni Dacha? Says the first opinion, Yud V'yad Kof, from 10 people to 100. Nive Rabbi Yoshia, these are the words of Rabbi Yoshia. So there's a minimum, it has to be more than 10, and there's a maximum, up until 100, but more than 100 would not receive the status of a Yerni Dacha, says Rabbi Yoshia. But Rabbi Yonasan argues and he says, no, the numbers are Mikuf V'yad Rubo Shel Shevet. Minimum is 100 people in this town, up until the majority of the entire tribe. So that gets a little closer, but it's still not close enough. As the Gemara points out, V'afilu Rabbi Yonasan Lo Kamra L'Rubo. Even Rabbi Yonasan, who has a much wider range here, to constitute Yerni Dachas, but even he only calls it Yerni Dachas up until the majority of the tribe. Avakula lo, clearly saying that if the entire tribe went and served the Avodah Zarah, it would not be judged as Yerni Dachas. So seemingly our Mishnah that says if an entire tribe did Avodah Zarah, now you need the Sanhedrin HaGadol, which sounds like it's saying it's considered an Yerni Dachas, doesn't fit with any of the opinions. The Gemara answers, Amar of Masna. Masna suggests that Hacha, continuing to Tez Zayin, Amid Aleph, here the Mishnah is talking about Binasi Shevet Shechata Skinan. Our Mishnah is not saying that all of the population of the tribe did Avodah Zarah, rather the Nasi, the prince of the tribe, did some sin that is subject to the death penalty. In such a case, our Mishnah says, the case would need to be judged by the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Based on what? Milo Amar Rav Ada Bar Ava. Says the Rav Ada Bar Ava, not say, that since the Pasuk in Yisro says, Kol Hadavar HaGadol Yaviu Eilecha, every great matter shall be brought to you, to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu is the equivalent, he was the president, he was the Rosh Sanhedrin of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. So it's saying, the great matter shall be brought to the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Rav Ada Bar Ava interpreted the Pasuk, he said, included in this Pasuk is, it's saying, Devarav Shel Gadol. And also if there's a matter involving a gadol, a great person, a great leader, Hainami Gadolu. Clearly, a Nasi falls under this description. He is a gadol, he is the leader of the whole tribe. So the point is, if he is being judged for a capital case, the Torah is saying that has to be brought to Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning at that time means brought to the Sanhedrin HaGadol. So that's what our Mishnah is saying. Another interpretation, Ula Amar Rabbi Elazar, Ula said the name Rabbi Elazar. Our Mishnah is discussing a case of Bevayan al Iske Nachlos, where members of a tribe are coming to the court with a case that deals with how to apportion different parts of Eretz Yisrael. There's a dispute about the borders of Eretz Yisrael, the different Shvatim. And our Mishnah is teaching that v'ketchilasa shel Eretz Yisrael, we have to process such a case the same way as we did when Eretz Yisrael was being apportioned at the time of Yeshua ben Nun for the first time. That is, matchilasa shev me'echad. Just as when Eretz Yisrael was being apportioned by Yeshua, it was done through 71. It was with Yeshua and his Zekanim through the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Afkan Shivim Be'echad. So too, if some issue comes up later among the Shvatim, but territory, how to apportion things, it has to be done through the Sanhedrin HaGadol. That's what the Mishnah means when it talks about this case of a whole tribe. The Gemara questions this reading. Gemara says, if that's what's going on in the Mishnah, Imat Chilase Kalpi Urim V'tumim V'kol Yisrael. If you're going down that road, you're talking about a case involving how to apportion Eretz Yisrael itself, well then, if the requirements are based on what was needed in the time of Yeshua, then we should say that just as in the time of Yeshua, it wasn't just to the court, Rather, as the pasuk describes, they consulted the Urim v'Tumim. They had, you know, of course, in the Choshen, worn by the Kohen Gadol, but worn by Elazar then, they would ask the Urim v'Tumim, which had the name of Hashem written on there, and the letters would light up on the Choshen, telling them the answer, a clear, a miracle, a clear message from heaven as to how to apportion Eretz Yisrael, and the whole Klal Yisrael was present at that ceremony. So all of that was needed by Tchilas Hashem Eretz Yisrael. So I've Kan Kalvi Urim v'Tumim Klal Yisrael. So your idea would suggest that any time there's a Nachal issue in the future, you need all of those things. When that's simply not the case, it's not true. We don't need that whole process. If an issue were to come up, you know, like nowadays or later on, involving dividing Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, the Gemara says, Ela mechavurta k'der Rav Masna. Rav Masna's approach that we're talking about with the Nasi, the prince of the tribe, did a sin that's, you know, capital case, seems a clearer interpretation of the Mishnah. The Gemara now revives the original interpretation we had above, and that is, Ravina Amar la'olam mishevet shehudach. Really, we'll say, like we said originally, that the Mishnah is referring to a case where the whole tribe was hudach, went off and served Avodah Zarah. Now, with the kakash shalach, bedina de rabim daininan le, as far as your question that, based on the known opinions, there should not be a case of yirni dachas here, which requires the Sanhedrin HaGadol, because even the most flexible view said that we do it up to the majority of a tribe, but not of the entire tribe, when it did Avodah Zarah. Ravina says to that, yes, we actually would use the Sanhedrin HaGadol in this case where the entire tribe did Avodah Zarah. For Afa gav di katlinan biyachid, even though you correctly point out that we see that according to all opinions, we wouldn't treat it as an actual Ir Nidachas case, which includes the halacha, the death penalty is through the sword rather than through stoning, and the property is to be destroyed. You're right that those halachas would not apply if the entire tribe did Avodah Zarah. However, Bedina de Rabim Daininan Lay, as far as the type of court we use the type of court that is used for the case of Ir Nidachas. It's not actually the case of Ir Nidachas. However, since we're talking about where the whole tribe did Avodah Zarah, therefore we require the Sanhedrin HaGadol of the 71 judges. That's what the Mishnah is saying. Ravina backs up this interpretation. He says, Milo Amar Rabbi Chama Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Oshaya. Rabbi Chama and Rabbi Yossi not teach us in the name of Oshaya. And since the Torah says, regarding the death penalty for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, says the Torah, V'yotzei says, Ha'ishahu, shall take out that man, or that woman, take them out to She'aracha, out to your gates, which is a way to refer to the Sanhedrin of the city, the Sanhedrin of 23, of that city, by the city gate, and that court will sentence that man or woman to death for Avodah Zarah. Hoshaya infers from the pasuk's language that ish v'isha ata motzi l'sharecha. If it's an individual, it's an individual man or woman, and that person is being tried for Avodah Zarah, you take that person to the Sanhedrin of the city of 23 judges. V'iyata motzi kol ha'ir kula l'sharecha. But not in a case where the entire city has worshipped Avodah Zarah. Rather, in that case, it would have to be taken to the highest court, to the Sanhedrin HaGadol. So now, if Rav Hoshaya is saying that when it's the entire city, you can't go to a Sanhedrin Ketana of 23 judges, Achanam, here as well. If you tell me where the whole tribe did it, then certainly, Yish Vishat Tamotzi L'Sharecha, by an individual, then you take that person to the Sanhedrin Ketana of 23 judges, to judge the case of Avodah Zarah, v'iyata motzi kol ha'shevet kulo l'sharecha. But if the entire tribe did Avodah Zarah, then you don't go to Sanhedrin Ketana. That has to be brought to Sanhedrin HaGadol. And that, says Ravina, is what our Mishnah is teaching us.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shir. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD-1. That's 855-275-7231.